What is the future of farming? Can traditional crop and livestock production be sustained? Is it more of the same, or do we need an entirely new model? Well, the best people to ask that are farmers themselves, and we have three of them, and I'll introduce them in order. Jackie Folsom is president of the Vermont Farm Bureau. She's also president of the Vermont Farm Bureau Service Company and has previously served as vice president of Vermont Farm Bureau, women's chair of Vermont Farm Bureau, and a member of the American Farm Bureau Dairy Advisory Committee. In addition to all her Farm Bureau activities, Jackie is currently chair of the Advisory Council for the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, a director of the Champlain Valley Exposition, a trustee of the Eastern States Exposition, a member of the Vermont Dairy Task Force, and an executive committee member of the Northeast Dairy Leadership Team. Jackie and her husband, Roy, operate a 100-cow dairy farm with land in Washington and Caledonia counties. They have two children and two grandsons. Next to her is Professor Fred Magdoff. Dr. Magdoff is a professor of soils in the Department of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont. His specialty is in soil fertility and management. Fred emphasizes that he doesn't actually farm, even though he did have a dairy farm once, but in my book, anybody who works with the soil is a farmer. So, Fred, you're a farmer whether you want to be or not.
For today.
Fred's outreach activities include explaining how to apply ecological principles to agricultural production. He has published extensively on soil health and is a leading advocate for a whole system approach in which soil health plays a large role in preventive management. Fred has frequently worked abroad in agricultural and economic environmental issues and is also interested in political and economic issues that affect farming. He is the senior editor of the book Hungry for Profit, The Agribusiness Threat to Farmers, Food, and the Environment. At the end of the table, Ian Wishart. Ian Wishart and his wife Leslie operate Agassiz Farms near Portage La Prairie, Manitoba. That's about an hour's drive west of the provincial capital city of Winnipeg. Ian is first vice president of Keystone Agricultural Producers, or CAP as we call it. That's Manitoba's provincial farm organization. He currently chairs CAP's Environment and Assessment and Taxation Committees. Ian is the architect of Alternative Land Use Services, ALUS, or ALUS, as it's called, a unique conservation program that emphasizes farmers' contribution to the environment. And recently, the first ALUS pilot project was launched in Manitoba. Others are planned for Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario, and Prince Edward Island. The Wishart Farm has a 200-head cow-calf operation and grows forages, specialty crops, and potatoes. Ian and Leslie have two daughters. So we'll ask them for a brief presentation giving their perspective on agricultural sustainability and the future of farming, 10 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to questions. Jackie, would you like to start?
I guess I'm next in line. Thank you, Ron. I guess my answer to that question would simply be yes. I mean, I wouldn't be here today if I thought that my business would not be here tomorrow. Having said that, the farm bureaus across the country, for those of you who aren't familiar with them, there are farm bureaus in every 50 states, plus Puerto Rico is part of our federation. And in Vermont, we have about 4,000 members, and we are primarily a lobbying organization, as are the other farm bureaus. We lobby at the State House in Montpelier and also down in Washington, D.C. And oftentimes, because of the fact that we are in Vermont and in New England, which has a different type of agriculture than some other parts of the country, we have to lobby at American Farm Bureau, too, in accordance with the other farmers who are also pushing agendas for sustainability or maintaining their farms. I've just come back from 2 days in Oneonta, New York, where we had some terrific people involved in discussing the future of the dairy industry. And for the first time in a long time, which is another reason why I say, yes, there is a future, particularly for dairy farming, we had processors, in other words, we had folks like Kraft who buy milk. We had milk promotion folks who are actually paid by a deduction from my milk check and others in the dairy industry to promote the safety and nutritional factors of our products. We had secretaries of agriculture. We had a lot of farmers. We had Farm Bureau people. And we are working on a memorandum of understanding between Pennsylvania, New York, and Vermont because we are the three largest milk-producing states in the Northeast. For the most part, Vermont's milk goes south. We have about 600,000 people in this state. We make a much larger quantity of milk than we are capable of consuming, and our milk shed is what they call it. Our marketing area is south, Boston, Hartford, Providence, New York City, Washington, D.C. So when Vermonters try to make a difference in how our milk is priced, it's based on a lot of things happening in other areas of the country that we do not have control over. But we're working on that, and that's been a stretch in our industry. As Ron said, dairy farmers sell at wholesale and buy at retail. We also don't know what our price is going to be until 6 weeks after that milk leaves our farm. Some of this has to do with the way, a lot of it has to do with the way the federal government set up a guaranteeing that there was going to be good, nutritious, safe milk down to the cities back in the Depression. And my contention of the mess that we're in now is that instead of throwing the whole system out about 40 years ago when we realized there was a problem, we've continued to band-aid it to the point that it's really impossible for a federal fix. And that's why we've done things in this area, such as the Northeast Dairy Compact, where we've tried to get a better price back for our dairy farmers. I don't want to forget the fact that as a Farm Bureau president, I also represent a lot of other commodities. And in this state, it would be sheep, both for meat and cheese and milk and wool. And that group is also having their own issues. Regulations have made it very hard here for farmers who are growing sheep for wool to process that wool because of the things that come off of wool, such as lanolin, tend to clog septic systems. And so cities and towns don't want those kind of processing plants where it's going to adversely affect their processing plants, as it were. We also have development issues, which you might think odd in Vermont, driving around. I hope some of you took the chance to go on some of the tours, particularly the Cow Power Tour down at the Audettes. And I think you need to remember that although there's a large conservation movement here in Vermont, which is met very well by a lot of the farmers, for those of us of the average age of 55 to 60, which most of us are in the agricultural world, we're looking at retirement. And the land is our bank. That's all most of us have. So whether we sell it to another farmer or we sell it to a developer, we really have to think long and hard about what we're doing to our communities. There are a lot of pressures, as Ron said, on farms and farmers. And we in Vermont are working from the administration right on down to those of us that are in the field, so to speak, to try to come up with a way to keep us going. And I want to make sure that you understand we're not trying to be saved. I hate that word applied to agriculture. I don't need to be saved. I need to be considered a business, no matter what size the farms are. And I need to be able to make a decent dollar for what we are doing on our farm. I think, for the most part, consumers want that, but I think they're just as confused as to how to make that happen because, as Ron said, once my milk goes off our property or once wool is sold, it goes into the next value, the next piece of the food chain, and we have no control over that. So we're trying to educate consumers more. Certainly that's one of the reasons I'm here to talk with you folks and hope to have a conversation about how we can do that. I don't have any simple answers, but my answer to the question of if we're going to survive is indeed yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Fred?
Can I use this one? Well, since I'm not really a farmer, I thought I'd start off with a saying that is about 50 years old from Vermont that I use when I talk to farmers, which I do talk to farm audiences quite frequently. And it goes like this. It used to be anybody could farm, because all you needed was a strong back. But nowadays, you need a good education so you can understand all the advice you get so you can pick out what will do you the least harm. And this is This is a Vermont saying from about 1950-something, and boy, it's as true today as it was then, and there's a lot of advice coming at farmers on all sorts of issues, and boy, you really do have to figure out what's going to cause you the least harm. Let me start with sort of one aspect of what I see of the issue here, dealing with environment, sustainability of farms, economics, etc. One of the main ecological problems that I see in agriculture has really been caused by the separation of the animals, not all of them, but certainly of the factory farms, these really large farms, from the land that grows their feed. And so you have tremendous concentrations of animals in certain places like the Delmarva Peninsula, like in North Carolina, Arkansas, etc., where you have a tremendous accumulation of nutrients, more than they know what to do with, and you have the farms that are growing the feed for these animals that need to buy fertilizers that, of course, especially nitrogen fertilizers, are very energy costly to produce. And so you have a basic rupture, if you will, of the nutrient cycle because of this. This is something which is really not complete in animal agriculture, but certainly within the large-scale production of cows. I'm talking about beef cows, hogs, and poultry. This is the case. This, by the way, of course, comes about 100 years after the first rupture, I would say, or the first rupture in the ecological cycle, which is really when people started moving to the cities during the early development after the Industrial Revolution. And you lost that connection with the land, and you had the same problem there. You had people writing in the 1850s and 1860s about the lack of nutrients going back on the farm and the tremendous amount of pollution in the rivers in England. And this has been cleaned up to some extent, but we still have that issue with us. Okay. So in addition to that issue, of course, in these factory farms, I think, as you're all well aware, many times the animals are not treated humanely. The tails of hogs have to be docked because they will eat one another. Actual cannibalism, the chickens' beaks have to be, when they're kept in tremendous confinement, they have to be de-beaked because they'll peck at one another. They will do things that they would not naturally do if they had more space and more humane environment to live in. This obviously is not all production. This does not apply to most dairy farms, but it does apply to especially the hog and the poultry operations, and to a certain extent the beef operations as well. Well, we certainly know that there are ecological ways to raise crops and animals that are ecologically sound. And it is, I would say, in many cases, these are not necessarily the most profitable ways to raise commodities that you're going to sell in as an undifferentiated commodity into the system, such as milk from Jackie's farm, or wheat, or corn, or cotton, as just plain corn, number two corn, priced at Chicago at so many dollars per bushel. That's the general commodity system. And I would say that in most cases, using the best ecological principles, you will not be able to sell into that system as a economically. In other words, your cost of production will probably be too high. Given the economics of the current food and agriculture system, where farmers have, as Jackie said, few places to purchase their inputs, and you're purchasing them at wholesale, and few places to sell your outputs, maybe one or two places and that's it, farmers have essentially no price power at all, pricing power at all, in the conventional system. Okay? So given this environment, I've come up with eight, I would say, ways to respond to the situation. And these are not mutually exclusive. Okay? So you, in some cases they are, in other cases they aren't. And I think you'll see. One of them is to stay in the system, do it the way you've been doing it, but just get larger and take full advantages of economy of scale. And you've got thousands and thousands of acres of underproduction owned by one family, just producing corn and soybeans, let's say. I mean, you've got to have at least 700 acres, or is it 1,300 acres now in Iowa, just to break even. And there are not only physical advantages of scale, there are economic advantages of scale which go beyond the physical. So that as farmers buy things, they pay less for them. When you're buying more quantity, when you sell things, it turns out you get more per unit if you're selling larger quantity. And your interest rates are lower also. The more money you borrow, the lower percent your interest rate. I was astounded to learn this, but it turns out, I came back, talked to the person in Farm Credit, absolutely true, Fred. You want to borrow $1 million instead of $100,000 that you have with us when I had the dairy farm? He says, absolutely, we'll drop your percent interest by 0.25%. So there are financial advantages in addition to the other. So one answer to this is, to the economic problems that we're talking about, is basically do what you've been doing, but just get larger, take full advantages of all that, and of course the government programs. Another response, and again, this is not mutually exclusive, is reduce your cost of production as much as possible. And there are farmers who are using that as their main approach. Don't use as much fertilizer. We've been over-applying it. And so there are ways, actually, to cut back and not really cut production very much at all. In Vermont, one of the ways to lower your cost of production is to use intensive grazing management on a dairy, where your production does go down, but your costs go down substantially because you don't have to harvest forage during the growing season, and you don't have to spread the manure that animals spread themselves during that season, only during the confinement season in the wintertime, and there are labor savings as well. A third response is one which I find kind of sad, but within the poultry and hog industry, there are people who have decided they're becoming contractors for the large integrators. And they essentially, I would not call them farmers, I think they still call themselves farmers, but they really are workers for Purdue, workers for Murphy Family Farms, workers for one of these large integrators. They don't own the animals, they don't own the feeds, they're told what to do, how to do it. They own only the infrastructure and, of course, the manure. So they own nothing in between, but they own the manure at the end, which is, of course, a problem because they don't have the land base to get rid of it. Another answer, which is one that farmers have done for quite a while, is nothing new really about it, but to try to join or develop a new cooperative where you can buy and sell your things at some advantage over individual farmers. A fourth, and you'll be hearing more about a diversified farm, is to diversify the products on your farm. Instead of just growing one crop or two crops, and out in the Midwest, if you drive through Iowa, it's hard to see anything but corn and beans, you grow some other crops. And by diversification, there are many, many benefits of diversification ecologically as well as economically. And also, I would say diversification of crop farms where you try to get animals back onto the farm so that you reunite the animals with the land that grows their feed is something which has tremendous possibilities, especially because you have people who are very interested now in how their food is raised and how their animals that they eat are treated. So there are really options for doing that and making some real money doing that, and there are people doing it quite successfully. Produce a higher value product. For example, in Vermont, we've had a few apple orchards that have gone out and gone into vineyards. Vineyards potentially are going to be quite a bit more profitable. Medicinal herbs, organic production, and, of course, humanely treated animals is another higher value product, shall we say, that you're producing. Sell directly to the public. This is another one. Or the end user. There's tremendous interest and a lot of people doing this successfully. Selling through farmers markets. By the way, the last Burlington farmers market is today for the year. October, unfortunately, lousy weather for them. And I hope to get down there later and pick up some things. Through CSAs, I don't know if you all know what those are, but community-supported agriculture farms, which we have quite a few of in Vermont, where people buy shares in them, and actually in the urban areas in New York City, you're having CSAs from farms from the Hudson Valley and from New Jersey coming into New York City and actually distributing the food there, but organized along the same lines. But also selling to schools directly or to restaurants directly rather than going through middlemen. So selling directly to the public or the end user. And the last one that I can think of, and there may be more, is adding value to your product. And again, these are not mutually exclusive. But in the dairy industry here in Vermont, there are examples of dairy farmers making their own yogurt, making their own ice cream, bottling their own milk and selling it. And of course, the farmstead cheeses, not only in the milk, in the cow dairy, but also sheep and cheese dairy. And of course, we have a buffalo dairy too, making mozzarella. So you're adding value to the product, and there's ways to do it with other products as well, at the farm or cooperatively. A group of farmers together can do it. So I think that these are the options, and there are some very successful examples of the people doing this, and that is selling locally, adding value, and in essence getting out of the commodity chain. So that you're not selling an undifferentiated commodity, you're selling Lewis Creek carrots, Lewis Creek Farm carrots, which is not far from here, and Hank will be down at the market today selling all the products that they have. So instead of just an undifferentiated carrot, it is differentiated. You know who you're buying it from, you know how it was grown, etc. And he's not organic, by the way, but a very, very good and very progressive grower, very interested and concerned about the environment. Okay, let me end up with just some challenges to these other options, I would say. One is that many of them are niches, and niches by their very nature, you know, can't get too big in a certain area, because if they do, you've lost your niche. And one of the issues certainly that happens with medicinal herbs or flowers or things like that, that are going to have a limited market in a given area if you're going to try to sell local. Some farmers are not good at dealing with the public, and so they like to farm. They're good at farming. They're just not good at selling and at dealing with the public, and so some of this is not for them. And then there's the issue now that we have in the organic industry of you have what should be an oxymoron, but you have actually factory organic farms. And it's almost impossible for local organic growers to compete with them. There was a situation a few years back when a farmer in the Connecticut River Valley of Vermont plowed up his lettuce because it was in the field, but he could not harvest it and get it to the Boston market. Again, he was selling it as an organic commodity for the price that organic lettuce was being sold at the Boston market coming in from California. And this is even before the organic standards went into effect. So that's become even more so. So this really creates the importance, and this is where a lot of people are putting their emphasis now, on the local. Whether it's organic or not organic, it doesn't make any difference, but trying to put stress on what you can do by supporting local farmers and buying local foods, and so whether it's value-added or not value-added, but not in the normal commodity chain. So I would say the traditional ways of growing food, they will still exist. And it's probably going to be in the large-scale, heavily capitalized farms that do this. I think it's these alternate farms that are growing now in numbers and growing in, I would, as far as I can tell, consumer demand. And it's not just for organic. It's for local. It's for humanely treated animals, etc. And there are people who have said, and I've heard organic farmers say it too, I would rather buy a local product, whether it's organic or not, than buy a product from somewhere else. And that type of mentality, and the local could be from, depending on how you define it, right next door, it could be the state. Some local is being defined as regional or sub-regional as well. I think I better quit.
Ian?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Certainly a different group than I generally talk to. I spend most of my time talking to either government officials with lobbying, which is not always the most productive enterprise, or farmers, which often gets you a very interesting response. My role at Keystone Ag Producers is a little different, I guess, and I'm not going to talk about my own farm operation here very much, though I'll certainly be prepared to talk about it if anybody's curious. But we're a very diversified farm operation, as the reference was made. But on behalf of Manitoba farmers, I've been very active in lobbying for a different type of approach to agriculture for the future, one that does not focus solely on the food and fiber issue, which is traditionally what we produce, but actually goes back to the consumer in many ways and makes the link. And the way we do that is through environmental issues, a concept called environmental benefits, as Ron has referenced in my introduction, and a program called Alternate Land Use Services, ALICE, as we call it up there. There's some real drivers, and you've heard about some of them already. Farm incomes in Canada actually are in dramatically worse shape than they are in the U.S., if you can believe that. We have had three of our worst years in history since 2000, with net farm income in many commodities showing negative numbers and some years substantially negative numbers all across Canada. Last year, which was probably the worst year, only two provinces out of 10 showed positive net farm incomes. Farm debt has risen dramatically. It's actually four times what your average American farmer is. So we are at a crossroads, and the issue of rising input costs, as has been referenced, is just as much up there. We compete for the input costs against American farmers, so we're basically in the same boat on that. There's some slight regulatory differences, which does lead to some slight price differences, but they're basically the same thing, especially the energy-generated ones. We do have some sectors, the ones we call supply-managed, which include the dairy and the poultry, that have supply-demand balancing process, and that sector is doing better. It has some issues. You buy quota to be in that sector, so that quickly became heavily capitalized, and that's one of the drawbacks to the system. So it has tended to maintain farm size in that sector. There hasn't been any growth. Farm is often smaller, but it has made them very less than competitive in many aspects, and it has not grown that industry the same as you've experienced down here. So it's a little less than perfect. But I'm a great believer in what I call the three sets of books, and that's not one for the bank and one for the tax man and one real one, though that's not a bad idea. But really I'm talking about environment, social, and economic. And eventually you have to balance those three sets of books. And in many sectors of agriculture, we haven't necessarily been doing that particularly well. And certainly in Western Canada and even in the U.S., where rural depopulation has been a very dramatic issue, it's obvious we haven't been able to keep the social balance to the same degree. Now, those are big challenges to try and balance those, but we as farmers believe we can play a role, particularly on the environment side, and it does spill over into the social side, and I won't really get into all the value-added initiatives we would like to do. We're a few years behind you on the bioenergy, ethanol and biodiesels, but we're certainly looking at that. And the issue of whether or not you take that out of the food balance or the food chain in Western Canada is not there. We export most of these commodities anyway, and up to 80% of them actually are exported in some particular commodities. Nobody's going to starve to death because we're going to make biodiesel. That argument just doesn't carry any ice in our part of the world at all. The issue is whether it's economic and whether or not we will have a competitive marketplace to sell into. For you guys in the U.S., and I just was through Wisconsin, Minnesota, looking at ethanol and biodiesel plants, you seem to have maintained a high level of farmer ownership. We have none of that. ADM is building a plant at Velva, North Dakota. Two other multinationals are building in Manitoba. Their intent is to make biodiesel. Any one of those plants will take all of the canola production, which is the base for that, will take all of the canola production out of Manitoba. Just like that, all gone. But farmers will own none of any of those plants, so any of the flow back to the rural community is dramatically removed. So we have some issues there. I'll just go a little further then and talk about our alternate land use services, if I could. And it's a program we've been working on since 1999 in Manitoba, and we have some partners in it. And for Canada, this was new because we have no CRP or anything like that up there, no conservation sector of our farm bill. In fact, we have no farm bill. Our supports are, if we get them, are either crop insurance or whole farm concept. The whole farm program hasn't been working particularly well. It's clearly anti-diversification. It's anti-value-added and hasn't been managed particularly well. And I won't go into that, but it certainly doesn't seem to be working too well for us. But the partners we developed in this were wildlife people. In our case, it was Delta Waterfowl. You may be familiar. It's an international organization, both sides of the border, hunter-supported down here in the U.S., and we provide, they do a lot of landscape management, some set aside, that sort of thing that they pay for, easements and that sort of thing in Manitoba. But we continue to have a dramatic loss in wetlands, particularly in Western Canada, which is the duck production area of North America. We're losing 8% of our wetlands per year at an increasing rate. So obviously they were worried about that. And once they heard of our program, and our program provides to farmers a direct payment benefit for maintaining and enhancing the existing, plus any new that they care to develop, wetlands as one of the roles, they thought this was a very good mechanism to do it. It's a working landscape model. It's not full set-aside, so that there is some limited use allowed on the part of the farmer, and that is therefore not so negative in terms of its impact on the rural community. But they chose to support it, and so we worked with them very diligently, and we've managed to convince all our levels of government. And we have three levels to deal with that have authority in agriculture, to some degree the municipal. Provincially, they're quite active in ag policy, and federally, they're quite active in ag policy. So getting three levels of government to agree on anything takes a long time. We also have managed to attract some dollars from NGOs for this type of program, and we see that as part of the future. And interestingly enough, some of that money comes from U.S. states. We have money from Mississippi and Tennessee state game commissions to support these programs because of the waterfowl connection. And that's a first. The other thing that's a first in this program in Canada is we actually have municipal contributions, dollars on the table, not in kind, but in terms of water benefits, because there's when you manage wetlands differently, you have dramatically different water benefits. We lowered some of their flood costs, maintained better water quality issues for domestic water with a program like this, and they put significant money on the table too. So it's a whole different revenue stream to primary producers for providing a public benefit, an environmental benefit, something that they were doing to some degree but in a decreasing level. The pressure to straighten out the field and get rid of that wetland in terms of drainage was quite dramatic. We're paying taxes on those acres. It cost us up to 15% more per year to go around this thing than straight down the field when we're planting crops. So we were losing them at a very dramatic rate. It also has generated what I would call a change in attitude, and that's what we're really after on part of farmers. Instead of just food and fiber, traditional things, get it out of the country as quickly as possible, lose as much money as you can on it. not quite, really. Now we become landscape managers, and we have had some real good success at that, and it is a great opportunity in our mind to reconnect the urban and rural person over environmental issues. We're very further removed from our customers than you are. Manitoba's population, slightly more than 1 million people, that takes about 6% of the province to supply everything to, if you were to assume that we did grow everything there. So the rest of it's just going out of the province, and Saskatchewan and Alberta are very much the same way. And that's really where all the acres are. And most of our customers are overseas. I never talk to a customer in Thailand on weed issues. It's just not done. The structure's not there to do that. And very little of that sort of stuff is done. So it's a real challenge for us to try and keep track of what our customers want and where we're headed in the future. Just to give you a little example, our project in Manitoba is a 3-year pilot in one municipality, somewhat the same as your county structure. There's about 130 farmers in that particular area. We have over 100 of them enrolled. This is a fully voluntary program, nothing mandatory about it, which was much higher. It's about 75% enrollment rate in terms of acres, in terms of farmers, and 17% of the acres. And we had identified 19% of the acres as eligible for these types of practices, so we're really right up there for a voluntary program. In fact, in terms of conservation programs in Canada, this type of participation is simply unheard of. They usually run in the 2 to 3% range. So this is a dramatic difference. It's managed through a new mechanism. We work with the watersheds a lot in terms of the technical know-how, but the flow of information and the flow of dollars is managed by our Ag Services Corporation, our crop insurance agency, because, in fact, they traditionally tracked all those acres anyway. And so when they're not producing a crop and now they're producing an environmental service, for them it was already a data entry in their records. This was simply a very efficient way to do it. Traditionally, conservation programs, whether they're NGO or government, in our part of the world, have an administrative cost running in the 20 to 30% range. Probably the same down here, though I guess I wouldn't really know that. Our administrative costs related to this are estimated to be 2 to 3%. So a whole factor different. And obviously there's some real efficiencies to be gained there. Now, reference has been made to other provinces. This is a pilot project, first of its kind in Canada. If you want a, you know, sort of a general description of how it works in the landscape, it has some aspects of what you use in the U.S. programs with CRP or CREP, but it also provides or incorporates some of the thinking that went into the European multifunctionality approach, where everything is actually a working landscape and there are a number of benefits that can be obtained from the same acre, and it attempts to put programs in place that maximize these benefits for all the players. That's dramatically different for us. I mean, we've had really nothing like this type of program, even CRP programs. We've had some small set-aside programs in the past, but we're really moving in a dramatically different direction. And the type of uptake that we've had, I'm getting the one-minute signal here, has been an indication that we obviously have some success in that area. I won't give too many more details in terms of acres or anything, but we are hopeful to run this out in terms of pilots across Canada. We've had a number of provinces express interest. When I go to speak to farm organizations, they're generally always interested in this type of approach. It's different. But getting governments engaged has been a bit more of a challenge. But the pilot approach is the way we hope to fine-tune it. And in terms of managing the level of payments and the types of activities, that is done through community committees, which include the non-farmers. So there's a lot of local buy-in and a lot of local control. And that, too, sells particularly well because the reference was made to having to have the education to know what advice not to follow. We've been getting an awful lot of programs that are prescribed for us and haven't necessarily been adapted to our local environment particularly well, and this is completely different. We're in the evaluation process, and we're certainly hopeful that it'll be picked up. We don't have a farm bill in Canada. We do have a quote, ag policy framework that we've been operating under for 4 years, and it's about to be renewed. It is not very specific in programs and not particularly good in indicating what direction, and it's not focused. Basically, what they did is this is the first one they've done, which is a step in the right direction, but they swept up all the existing programs and called it a policy framework and said, okay, we're going to work with that. Hopefully the second round, and we've just begun consultations on that, will be more focused and more farmer-friendly, and we'll have a clear view of the future, and we're very hopeful that something like an ALICE program or at least an environmental goods and services approach will be incorporated into that. So thank you very much. I guess Ron knows me very well, and I'm the eternal optimist. I'm always looking for solutions in agriculture, and I do believe there are some. This is just one of many.
Thank you, Ian. Ian has copies of his presentation on the table, and we'd encourage you to take one on your way out if you haven't got one already. Well, what do you think? What's the future of farming? Time now for question period. And this has to be very sharply timed because just a few minutes before noon, we have to go directly downstairs to the luncheon session. So we'll try and keep this within these boundaries. Yes?
I have a question
Okay, I'm just going to finish the preamble. There are rules, SEJ rules, for a question period, and that is you have to be an SEJ member or a working journalist to get priority for asking questions. Please identify yourself, where you are, where you're from, who you're associated with, and we can repeat the question for the audience or for the panel if it's not clear. So we'll start with you. Jackie?
Thank you. In Vermont, actually, and I'll speak because that's where I know the most about it, our farmers here, particularly the ones, as Fred mentioned, who are the local farmers and who are working within their communities, both through CSAs and farmers markets, have actually benefit in regards to the problem that there is, but it has really promoted more the Buy Local campaign that the Agency of Agriculture has had in effect for a couple years. And so I believe even Hank was on the front page of the newspaper saying, you know me, you know where my product comes from, you can come to my farm and see what I'm growing. And it actually was almost a reverse marketing effect for a lot of our small growers, not just the organic, but anyone who was growing food to sell locally. I don't think there was any adverse effect, and Fred, you could probably know better than I, but in this state, I don't believe there was an adverse effect because we really promote buying from the local farmers, and they really did a good job in reminding people. They actually did. It was actually a good thing for our state. That's where I guess I defer to Fred on that. I haven't heard.
Yeah, I haven't heard. I think one of the key things that it points out, and this is, you heard it repeated by local people and others as well, is that this couldn't happen to the extent that it happened, the number of states, the number of people that got sick, the number that died, only a few, although there are apparently more that may have died from it and were not, and the cause was not determined. This couldn't have happened if you had local supplies, relatively few, a lot of different farmers supplying whatever it is, lettuce or spinach or whatever. One of those farms can be contaminated, certainly. E. coli, especially this E. coli, which is antibiotic resistant, is a very dangerous bug, believed to be developed in the cattle industry because of the high concentrations of high amounts of corn concentrate fed to these animals, giving them conditions in the rumen which allowed, and also continuous antibiotics being given to animals that are in confinement. So you get the antibiotic-resistant strains. But it's become very prevalent. So wherever it developed, however it developed in industrial agriculture, it has spread. And so I think what it does is it gives you an indication of what are the benefits of a local supply chain as opposed to a national, relatively small number of people controlling the supply chain, and also brought up a lot of issues outside of E. coli and vegetables, because just the whole issue of food poisoning. I was surprised by the number of people. I'm just trying to remember what the number was. It was like 75 million people in the United States every year have some sort of food poisoning. I mean, some of that must be, at a picnic where the mayonnaise stayed out too long, and some of it, I don't know where it's from, but it's just, that's an amazing number. I have no idea whether it's true or not. So it brought up the other issues, not just the local one. Not this particular one. So I would say the net effect with regard to Vermont is positive in the sense not only that you knew that you could buy from these people, that is the local producers, and not be getting California lettuce, that's number one. But number two, it reinforced this issue of local, reinforced that there is safety in the local production. not meaning, again, that you can't have contaminated lettuce or spinach grown in Vermont. You can, but it's going to be confined, the outbreak will be confined to a relatively small number of people if that happens. And I'm sure it will and can happen. So, of course, within the organic community, they are a little bit more careful because of the constriction or the confinement of manure to basically it has to be compost or it has to be put on long, long in advance of any crop for direct human consumption.
Yeah. Ian, I haven't noticed any spinach on the store shelves back home. We don't grow spinach locally because our climate doesn't support it. What are your observations on the subject?
Well, it certainly has been actually positive for the local vegetable industry because their sales went up. And it probably did two things constructive, I mean, in Western Canada. We've had, for the last few years, a number of problems getting access to the supermarket chains. They basically have gone down to one buyer. Works out of Calgary, which is not near us, and isn't interested in local production, orders it out of California. Simple. He makes one phone call, he gets what he wants. Mm-hmm. Now that's going to change, so we're told. So that's good. The other thing that we do that probably to a greater degree than you do is we have an existing traceability system. So if that had happened in Canada, we would have been able to identify probably within hours where that product came from, right down to the field level. And we've partly been driven to this because of the BSE situation. Cattle in Canada are all tagged. Almost all the livestock industries are now tagged or at least lot recorded. So we can trace well past the last point of sale, which is basically how your system works. You go to the last point of sale and hope that there's good records kept there. We have all of that recorded in a national registry. In fact, I had a traceability meeting on Monday. We're talking about expanding it to other sectors, and there are a number of options. We're not quite down to one system applied all across. We have some provincial variation, that sort of thing, so we're working on working that out. But we really can see the benefits of that type of system. And it was interesting, I was reading in one of your papers down here, you're talking traceability applied to cattle, and of course the farmers are resisting because no one's talking about how will they pay for it.
Yeah, it was in USA Today just yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually don't have the traceability. We've actually been a little disingenuous on that in that we forced Canada, because of the BSE issue, to maybe promote their program more than was happening, but we actually don't have anything near that in the United States because of the because of the resistance from, and a lot of it has to do with the cattlemen out west on the free range, but a lot of the dairy farmers are having issues with it too. So there is no traceability, there is no national ID program. Sorry, Ron.
Next question over there, and then there, and then there. My observation driving through rural Manitoba is that a lot of farms don't have gardens anymore. When I was a kid growing up on a farm, that was just simply basic, and now that seems to be going too. But anyway, Jackie, would you like to start?
I think Ron's observation is probably correct in Vermont. When we first started farming on our dairy, we were growing extra sweet corn and extra tomatoes, and we had a little market stand. It was cash in a mason jar, you know, and we didn't attend it, and we didn't have a lot of problems until one day we were up milking, and the horn was tooting, and somebody was screaming, I don't want these tomatoes here. I want the good ones. And my husband said, well, I'm sorry, I'm working here, and the woman was just absolutely rude and adamant about, no, you need to stop and go out and get me tomatoes. And he was one of the people that Fred was talking about that really didn't get along well at that point in time. So we were out of that business pretty quickly. I don't think a lot of farmers, it's like when Fred was talking about diversification, if you think back, diversification for 50, 60 years ago was the butter and eggs that the wife used to do. In most cases, we work off of the farms. That the diversification happens at my level because of the taxes and the health insurance. You know, certainly from the Farm Bureau perspective, we support the extension services, which works a lot with home gardeners. But, you know, as far as where it fits in with the farms, I think if you're talking about them canning or saving, you know, freezing things, it's very hard to find anymore because of the time issue for people. But it's something we support, obviously. People who know where their food comes from are a little better for me to talk to and educate about. Well, I can tell you where your milk comes from. So there's a relationship there that we can easily build on.
Next question over there.
Can I chime in on that?
Yes,
Ron, just a second. I think what your question referred to is mainly non-farmers growing food and how that fit into the system. And I think I think one of the major recreation sources in the United States, and a lot of people doing it. And I think what happens, we have a garden, a fairly extensive garden, is we don't buy from the local growers at the height of our garden. So in a way, we buy a lot at the beginning of the season, and we buy a lot at the end of the season. But in the middle of the season, we don't actually buy that much from the local growers because we're raising our own. I think it's good for health reasons. I think it's good also, especially for low-income people. The Sustainable Ag Research and Education Program also had some projects in cities where we're encouraging the use of land that's available, especially if it's not contaminated or then has to be decontaminated, for growing crops that can be used for direct food consumption or to sell to make some money. So I think there are a lot of possibilities that are part of this system.
Next question.
We actually don't have it in Vermont. We've just gone through. No, we haven't opposed it. We've withdrawn the proposal. There's a fine line because the Vermont Farm Bureau actually supports it. We support premise registration, and that was what was on the table in Vermont. It wasn't animal identification. But the smaller farmers were, and what they're calling the weekend or the hobby farmers were adamantly opposed to this because of misinformation that was out there. Currently, it's flipped back to a voluntary program, and there's only about 10 or 20% of the farmers involved in it. Dairy farmers are all identified because if you ship milk, they know where you are. But in Vermont, right now, the program has been withdrawn, so there isn't one even underneath the radar.
Sorry.
I'm sure it will. I understand that, but that's the background on that.
We have to move on. Next question. Ian, would you like to start?
Sure. We've had quite a movement even in Western Canada to organics. So it's seen as a market opportunity, particularly into Europe. One of the problems has been the variable standards issue has been a real issue. European organic standards are higher level than North American organic standards, generally speaking, so there's specific examples of otherwise. So it's created a lot of confusion, but it has provided some opportunities for some farmers, particularly in the grain sector, to get significantly more value for their production. We haven't, because of the lack of appropriate killing facilities, we have not had good access. Killing facilities in Canada are concentrated in fewer hands than you have down here even.
Next question over there. Sorry, could you speak up, please?
Sure. My name is Jenny. I'm a freelance writer. You outlined several mechanisms by which potentially farmers could shield
Who wants to start on the GMO subject? Fred.
You know, I wanted to talk about all those other ones, too, but I guess we don't have any time. But obviously, the GMO seed is one more form of control on the farm. It is not... If we set aside all the other potential issues out there, and I do think there are potential issues out there that are environmental issues of these materials being used, but just leave that aside. I see the major issue as it being one more form of control of agribusiness over the production process. It is not that different, though, and you need to keep from that point of view. It is not that different from hybrid corn, which was introduced in the 1930s by Henry Wallace and Pioneer Seed, because that was the first time where farmers couldn't save their seed because it wouldn't breed true. I mean, you could save it. No one, wasn't against the law. But if you saved your hybrid seed and you planted it the next year, you didn't get the same thing because of all that cross-pollination. So from that point of view, it's happened already, that issue in the seed industry going back to the 30s and probably into the 50s before 80 or 90% of the farmers in the United States grew hybrid seed.
Ian,
I think that's the major problem. I know. Sorry, trying to move this along.
Ian, tell the audience about Roundup Ready Wheat.
Roundup Ready Wheat, yeah. We have a marketing structure called the Western Canadian Wheat Board. It moves all our high-grade wheats into export markets. And, of course, Roundup Ready Wheat is a GMO, and there's been a move to introduce it. The customers through the Wheat Board have told us they don't want it. And there's been a huge debate going on with the private companies trying to find a way to force the Wheat Board to do that. Basically, they like to sell, in most of the marketplace, they like to sell a very uniform product. They say, no matter where they get it, that way they can go anywhere in the world and buy the lowest cost inputs to give this particular blend to a single desk buyer in Thailand. And we, as through the Wheat Board, have been offering a superior product in terms of quality issues by their definition of quality. And, of course, that gives us a competitive advantage over the ADMs or the Cargills of the world. So you know that they don't particularly care to maintain that competitive advantage. They'd like to find a way to get around that so that they can be competitive. So it's been a long, ongoing debate. But so far, we have not licensed any Roundup Ready wheats in Canada. We do have thousands of acres of GMOs in the canola market and have had for a long time, which has effectively shut down our access into Europe to some degree all the way through the process. But, you know, it's a long, ongoing debate. There are obvious benefits sometimes to GMOs, and the example I'll put forward is the GMO in the potatoes for the processing industry would have reduced the number of fungicide sprayings by a factor of about 90% had they been allowed to be used. No, our antitrust and competition laws are way weaker than yours. So, frankly, in terms of class actions and stuff, we have almost none of that ever.
Fred has a response, and then we have time for one more question. That's over there.
And, of course, you know, our antitrust laws aren't enforced, so it doesn't make much difference, really.
Yeah, the net result is the same.
One thing about it, also, American farmers have been very much opposed to GMO wheat. Okay, so it still has not been commercialized yet in the U.S., and one of the things that you can see, and this just happened with rice, by the way, is that when the companies talk about it, say, well, if you want to, we can keep it segregated. Well, we've learned with Sterling corn and now this recent occasion with rice that it is almost impossible to guarantee segregation of a GMO product from a non-GMO product of the same species. And they just will get intermixed one way or another. And where rice farmers are now in a huge problem trying to sell the rice that has been somewhat contaminated with a GMO variety that was not approved for human consumption.
But also back on the farm, you need to understand, too, that one of the reasons that farmers do embrace this technology, and particularly in soybeans, not soybeans in Vermont, but corn in Vermont, is because of the environmental issues that they assist us with. There, you don't have to go over and over. You don't have to apply fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides. So there, you have to be careful of just saying this is a horrible thing because of some stories. This has also allowed us to become more environmental friendly and a little bit more sustainable on the farm.
One more question. That's over there.
I'm sorry, could you speak up, please?
Sure. I'm an
Sorry, this is not the type of question to go out on. But I'm curious about top soil erosion and the legacy of that. I'm curious if the levels of inputs right now are sustainable and if this is a concern, if it's something that we can maybe expect in future yields to decline.
Well, let's have each one of the panelists answer that one, starting with Ian.
In terms of sustainability on inputs, I mean, that is we're competing for natural gas, so we're competing in the energy market. Our profitability is nowhere near those that want to drive the SUVs, the petroleum industry. So we're not looking too good on that. We're looking for other ways to do that. Livestock integration into the farm is obviously one way to do that. Unfortunately, we're also at that point in time where we're dealing with a lot of nutrient issues just because they've now become front and center. Mm-hmm. So we're not quite sure that we see a way out of this. There are a lot of acres in Western Canada that don't have livestock opportunities. We simply can't run that much livestock without increasing production by a tenfold. So we're never going to solve all the problems this way. We are looking at some other options. Most of our energy sources are hydro-generated, particularly in Western Canada. And there is a new technique out there to take the surplus power that occurs in hydro and turn that into nitrogen form. So perhaps that's one way we can get out of the oil industry marketplace. But it is the driving costs are really killing us.
Red?
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that except that the price of nitrogen fertilizer is intimately tied to the price of energy, and mainly natural gas, but you can use any energy source for it. I'll get back to the question of soil erosion. It is a major issue, not only in the United States. It's actually more of an issue in other countries. But the claim is made, and I have no way to verify it, whether it's true or not, that for every bushel of corn that's shipped down the Mississippi River, which is a major conduit for export of corn from the corn belt of the United States, there's 3 bushels of soil that are going along with it. I think that's probably accurate. Those are fairly erosive soils, those Lussell-type soils of the Midwest. One of our points, I mean our people who work in the area of soil health and soil management, is one of the things you can do, I mean, we see erosion as a major issue, and one of the things you can do is reduce the tillage. And that is, there has been a lot of reduced tillage technology used on American farms. It is not just no-till, which you may hear about quite a bit. A no-till is probably not very adaptable up here in the northern areas, but there's a reduced tillage called zone tillage, which there are some farmers using, some vegetable farmers using. I just got a call from an ag journalist about that, as a matter of fact. And there are other ways to do it, but that is one of the issues which such intensive tillage, leaving the soil bare, not using cover crops, that is, in the off-season, and using intensive tillage, you leave the soil in such a state that it really can't absorb the water. Therefore, the water runs off. Once water starts running off the soil, it's going to take soil sediments with it. And that's when you get your worst erosion. So erosion is a problem. It is causing a decline in the fertility of many of our soils. It is much of a worse problem abroad than it is here.
And very quickly, I think that farmers make their living from the land, and so it's incumbent upon them to find the best ways that they can make sure that that happens. There is a lot of work through the natural resource conservation programs to teach farmers to use buffer zones to keep the soils from runoff into the lakes and rivers. They are working, as Fred said, on no-till. The grazing issues for the dairy farmers also helps. And so there are a wide variety of programs out there to help us deal with this issue, because if the land flows down the Mississippi, obviously we're not going to be able to make a living off of it. So it's incumbent upon farmers, as Ron was saying earlier, when we start pushing that pencil at the beginning of the year, to also include the conservation programs that are available out there through the extensions, through the universities, and through the programs for the federal governments. And I think we are very aware of those programs.
Would you join me in thanking the panelists?